Detroit Stories, Episode 2, The Killing of Daniel Thomas, and the Aftermath. But before we begin, a full disclosure. This podcast is based upon actual events that occurred in Detroit, Michigan during the summer of 1967 and the winter of 1968/69. Source material is the Detroit Police Homicide File number 7129, The Murder of Daniel Thomas. Also, investigative articles by the Detroit News, the Detroit Free Press, and Michigan Chronicle reporters regarding this incident and the trial of the suspect Michael William Posholopek. All source material can be accessed through the Detroit Public Library's Burton Historical Collection, as well as the collection of official documents from the Jerome Kavanaugh administration. Further source material for the Detroit insurrection is Sidney Fine's Violence and the Motor City, the Kavanaugh administration, Race Relations and the Detroit Riot of 1967, as well as Detroit 1967, The Origins, Impacts, and Legacies by Joel Stone. And even though it's been 56 years since this heinous crime occurred, and that's still not a long time ago in terms of history and memory, I managed to reach out and actually locate someone who was there that night, whose assistance in filling in the invaluable spaces in many of the unknowns that couldn't be answered or even guessed at. And to that someone, I thank you ever so much. This podcast simply could not have been completed without you. And so if you have not listened to episode 1, The Killing of Daniel Thomas, I urge you to do so just to catch up to where we are at the moment and to put the events of that night in 1967 into proper context. But if doing so isn't an option for you at the moment, or if it's an issue of timeliness, or if you're a historian of urban insurrections, this podcast just might be what you've been waiting for, then please just sit back and listen, because you, above all others, understand that history and memory often collide, and thus placing the events of this podcast in the proper context should not be too hard and should prove to be a very interesting roadmap into those bitter times. And now, with that out of the way, welcome back to Detroit Stories, The Killing of Daniel Thomas, Episode 2. I am your host, Douglas Merriman. It's the very dead of a Michigan winter, December 1968. The weather is absolutely horrible. It's below freezing cold. The sky seems permanently angry, with sullen, low-grade clouds flowing steadily beneath an overcast sky, like an upside-down flood of dirty water. Sometimes it snows like tiny snow crystals that are driven into foot-high drifts by winter's steady winds. Sometimes thick, wet snowflakes float gently down from the dark gray clouds and stick to everything in an icy, windy, frozen, wet muck. It's miserable outside for sure, and there's slush and snert covering everything everywhere. And for the unaccustomed to local Midwestern vernacular, snert is a disgusting combination of winter-hardened slush, snow, and dirt that freezes and sticks to cars and trucks, undercarriage, and either has to be steamed off at the car wash or kicked off when the car isn't moving. Now, a lot has happened in the 18 months since Daniel Thomas was shot to death in bucolic Rouge Park deep on Detroit's west side. A lot has changed, and even more is going to change, because as Bob Dylan sang at that time, the times, they are changing. Richard Nixon is one of the most reviled men in the history of the White House, and he was elected president in November of 1968. He overcame an image of universal repulsiveness from his Eisenhower vice presidential years by becoming champion of the so-called quote-unquote silent majority, who deemed themselves of 99% white Anglo-Saxon God-fearing Protestants, who arose each morning to toil in America's manufacturing plants and in those feeder plants in the supply chain elsewhere that gave them a sense of purpose and a certain chest-beating proudness in being white, Protestant, and American, but not necessarily in that order. They faithfully attended segregated churches every Sunday. They listened aptly as their priests, pastors, reverends, and preachers waxed eloquent on the universality of American values, of which freedom, justice, economic opportunity, and a spiritual love for one's fellow Americans were foundational. They stood for the Pledge of Allegiance. They sang the national anthem whenever and wherever it was played or heard. But after LBJ's portrayal of signing the Civil Rights Act that strangled American apartheid in its grave and enforced its demise, the so-called riot-strewn summers of 1967 and 68, the quote-unquote silent majority, finally embraced Nixon's new mantra of, quote, restoring law and order 100%, unquote. They were fully on board with allowing the police to take control and take back the nation's great cities from the black militants, the white radicals, and the other disruptors of the nation's peace. Quote, law and order, unquote, was Nixon's and the Republican Party's buzzword for backing the police 100%, no matter what the cops did or how they did it. And even if the process sanctioned extrajudicial police violence, the cops and other figures of authority were to restore the honor, integrity, and the dignity of the existence of an America, which that time only existed on television, on My Three Sons and Father Knows Best, or on Bonanza reruns, where the patriarch Ben Cartwright represented righteous whiteness. The silent majority believed America was under an existential threat, an assault from the unholy machinations of the quote-unquote new left. Progressive things were happening in America, this is true, and mostly to the nauseating disgust of the conservative silent majority who wanted nothing more and mandated such when and where they could that things stay the same. And that they stay the way they had always been since Plessy versus Ferguson and quote-unquote separate but equal. Since that was ruled the effective law of the land by the Supreme Court. The silent majority reaped the whirlwind of social economic change sown by LBJ upon their neatly ordered world, and they were not happy that now, suddenly, the barbarians were at the gate. They fervently embraced the belief America was God's most favored nation on earth and chosen by God to reflect their Christian values in all of the glory of racism, segregation, inequality of opportunity. And they were ready to inflict maximum extreme violence upon anyone who did not see the world the same way as they did. They were that generation born between 1900 and 1930. They lived through the Depression from 1929 to 1940, and they lived through World Wars I, World Wars II, Korea, and Vietnam. And they had reaped the economic benefit of the post-World War II economic boom and the suburban home boom as they streamed out of the cities like lemmings going over a cliff. Life was very good for the quote-unquote greatest generation, but they had this one huge character flaw. They were largely racist, conformist, anathema to progressive social change of any sort, where everyone was entitled by birthright to all of the accoutrements of full American citizenship, no matter their race, creed, or color. And anyone who didn't sign onto that was promptly labeled a quote-unquote a troublemaker, a black militant, a white radical, a communist, or a socialist. And they were ultimately marked for violence. Either official state-sanctioned violence or otherwise violence enacted by so-called citizens' committees, often without legal consequence. Socially, economically, and politically, the greatest generation preferred things stay on lockdown, just the way they always had been since the 1940s. And they believed deeply, deeply in law and order, and that the authorities were incapable of ever doing anything wrong, unethical, or illegal. And please stop laughing. This is what they honestly believed. They harbored a deep disgust and a mistrust for the African-American civil rights movement and its leaders as well, whom many white folks believe were, quote, overeducated Negroes who did nothing but cause trouble, unquote. Most of the silent majority truly, truly believe, quote, the colored, that was the ethnic identifier assigned to people of color by the majority back then, especially the older people of the silent majority. They honestly believed that the colored had nothing to complain about. Most of them believed that Negroes had more white rights and privileges than the average white person, and they should be eternally grateful for everything they had. Therefore, the so-called silent majority believed, truly believed, any militancy erupting from African Americans what had to be due to the ungrateful outside agitators from the NAACP, or either Moscow or Peking, as it was then known, who were stirring things up and causing unnecessary trouble among the colored, as well as other problems. And otherwise, the colored, in their opinion, were a peaceful, submissive people who went about their daily lives with being subservient to the established social order. Of course, they cut up on the weekends, but that was amongst themselves. And so long as they kept it amongst themselves and there was no spillover into white neighborhoods, the powers that be firmly, firmly believed no harm, no foul. But what the silent majority despised above all else at that time in the 1960s were the young white radicals, Vietnam War anti-protesters, who magically appeared as if from a deep, dark, super secret progressive laboratory somewhere, where anti-American cultural agents were manufactured and dispersed throughout the country. The silent majority hated these 99% mostly white college-educated protesters and supporters who all wore beads, beards, sandals, long hair, you know, who wore strange clothes with weird colors. They loathed these people with a bottomless contempt. And they were convinced beyond all reasonable doubt that these good American kids had somehow or other been totally led astray or co-opted again by either Moscow or Peking or maybe both. And when it came to the Vietnam War, even if the silent majority was presented with incontrovertible facts regarding that war and America's somewhat nebulous and underhanded and unclear reasons for entering that war without invitation from the government of South Vietnam, they would wrap themselves in old glory and wouldn't budge, with their arms folded defiantly across their chest, much like a three-year-old refusing to eat spinach or defiantly refusing to go to bed at bedtime. They were conservative, nonconformists, pushing back against the mid-60s liberalization of the social order with the same entrenched reactionary traditional beliefs, values, and mores that has hobbled America's social progress since 1619. The only difference between the Puritans and the silent majority of the 1950s, the 60s, and the early 70s was Native Americans were now lived on reservations, and it was finally against federal law for white people to lynch Negroes without legal consequences. which some of the silent majority honestly viewed as a violation of their constitutional rights as white men. Going into December 1968, when Michael Poshelovic went on trial, 17,000 Americans had been killed in combat in Vietnam against the Viet Cong guerrillas and North Vietnamese Army regulars. From 1965 till 1969, 17,000 young men were battlefield casualties in a war that was supposed to be a non-major proxy conflict, but turned into a bloody fucking meat grinder. And then when the bodies of friends, neighbors, relatives, and other loved ones began turning home in greater and greater numbers in sealed military coffins, because military morticians are very good, but they were not miracle workers. And to put this into context for those times, 17,000 soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen killed in action is 1,400 men a month. That's 350 men a week. There's 50 dead a day. And that's not to mention the high hundreds of wounded each month. Not to mention the physically maimed, the psychiatrically and emotionally broken, who will suffer from PTSD and literally never recover from that experience for the rest of their lives. And in the nation's larger cities, the impact of that war played out thusly. In every neighborhood, everyone knew of at least three contemporaries, be they brother, friend, cousin, male relative, or acquaintance, who had been wounded, disabled, or killed in Vietnam. Almost everyone of military service age personally knew of at least six others who had been wounded, and this is the fabulous 6 degrees of separation. They had been wounded with life-altering disfigurement. In Detroit's high schools, at that time, Detroit had 22 high schools then, there were weekly assemblies in auditoriums to honor recent graduates who had fallen in Vietnam. Graduation photos were displayed on the auditorium movie screens, and these casualties were rarely older than 20 years old, and often the students in the auditorium personally knew the photos of the fallen up on the screens. And it was all so very surreal and sobering. And while these assemblies were meant to honor the fallen and bring home the principles of America's sacrifice, the effect was often quite the opposite. To the contrary, on the generation of the newly politically aware, that generation, my generation, they simply could not connect the dots of noble sacrifice and dying in a rice paddy or a mountainside 10,000 miles from Main Street and Elm. The ranks of the young people who resisted that war soon swelled to millions. The Vietnam War was a grinding, bloody conflict that was steadily galvanizing the student activist community from Michigan's colleges and universities. Now, if you think about it, this made sense no matter which context you choose to place it in, especially when one considers who was being drafted, who was being sent to the war, and who it was doing the dying. As patriotic as African Americans had always been during times of war, and despite the indignities suffered by them at home, this particular war was beginning to wear thin on even your African American patriots. African-American attitudes on the war were beginning to subtly shift as black Detroit soldiers returned home and brought back primary source observations and other revelations about the war, how it was being fought with an unspeakable savagery against the Vietnamese people and who were being killed by the hundreds of thousands, and the U.S. was not even blinking an eye. Now, at this point, the main anti-war coalitions in Southeast Michigan emerged naturally from Detroit's colleges and universities. And these were such as the Detroit Student Coalition to End the War, or the Detroit Committee to End the War, or the Students for a Democratic Society, or the Democratic Students for the Moratorium on the War. These organizations began to hold regular informational rallies on the war, what the war was truly all about and whether or not the Vietnam War was actually a moral or just war. Was it immoral or just a blood money windfall for defense contractors? And the student coalitions, they borrowed methods and tactics from the Black Civil Rights Movement, and they begin to hold teach-ins on campuses and sit-ins at armed forces recruiting stations throughout Metro Detroit. Protesters bodily block buses filled with draftees and recruits from leaving Fort Wayne Induction Center in Detroit, en route to basic training at Fort Knox, Kentucky, or elsewhere. But most infuriatingly of all to the quote-unquote silent majority and your hardline right-wing politicians, anti-war organizations begin to effectively mobilize and advise young, draft-age young men, both white, black, Asian, and brown, how to legally avoid being drafted, or, barring that, how to begin a new life in Canada in so-called draft exile, which thousands of young men availed themselves of, and much to the foaming outrage of the Greatest Generation, who firmly believe American values and manhood were being challenged worldwide without an appropriate hardline response from Americans. Now, as you can guess, these activities thoroughly enraged the silent majority and quote-unquote the establishment. This was another name for the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant power structure as it existed at that time. And it especially incensed police agencies across the country whose ranks brimmed with World War II and Korean War veterans. The cops looked upon the student anti-war organizations or any other anti-war organization as an anti-American betrayal of all things American. And some police organizations were convinced that these student organizations were giving aid and comfort to the North Vietnamese, who were doing a pretty good job of their own of sending America's young men back home in body bags. Some thought the anti-war protesters and draft resistors as nothing more than, I quote, scum-sucking traitors, deserving of the ultimate penalty for ignoring the nation's call to duty. And, you know, you can rest assured that this was an intense time. There were intense clashes between anti-war demonstrators and law enforcement. And some of these clashes were bloody affairs beyond description. Lots of people on both sides were seriously injured. Some were hospitalized with critical injuries. But the contrast in value between the two, the contrast in values was so stark. The police thought of themselves as, quote unquote, gatekeepers, in firm defense of the values of the silent majority that was slowly slipping from their grasp through disorder, chaos, and a very visible shift in generational values in terms of the rejection of segregation, apartheid, and discrimination of any kind, be it racial, ethnic, or gender. They viewed themselves, quote-unquote, as rolling at the pass, that last line of defense of, quote-unquote, law and order and traditional conservative values in an evolving world that, sadly for them, just didn't see the world in the same way. Their charge was to hold the line for the future of their children's children, and their children's children's children. And what the anti-war demonstrators didn't understand about the silent generation was how anyone who supported the Vietnam War could be so imbecilic as to not grasp what was really going on when the truth was on American national television newscast every night at 6 and 11. The saying went like this: if Walter Cronkite knew it, how could you not know it? Naturally, during the intensifying years of Vietnam, the anti-war coalitions and the Detroit police did not exactly have the very best of interpersonal relationships, I suppose you could say. And there were several very bloody clashes around the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Eastern Michigan in Ypsilanti, and especially around the Wayne State University campus area in Detroit between the cops and young people, whether they were protesting the war or not. And needless to say, there was already that bad blood that already existed between Detroit police and Detroit's black community and anyone else who wasn't in police blue or sheriff's brown uniform. This attitude was force multiplied by the significant numbers of Detroit police and sheriff's deputies who fought in either World War II or Korea. And to place this into context, in 1967, World War II had only ended 22 years before in 1967, and in Korea only 13 years before. In terms of history and memory, these two bloody shooting wars were kind of like yesterday, which made the cops and deputies' attitudes toward anybody challenging the authority of the United States government to send young people to die in a war no one understood and was becoming increasingly unpopular by the minute. Attitudes were grim and unyielding. I suppose you could say that, in short, extreme violence lurked just beneath the surface. And when this extreme violence exploded, it sent ripples throughout Metro Detroit that washed up and down the road in unexpected places with long-reaching consequences. And there were lots of combat veterans who were in the ranks of the Detroit Police and the Wayne County Sheriff's Department. And for the most part, these guys were in their mid-30s to their late 50s. They saw the anti-war protesters not only as scum, but anti-American traitorous scum, anathema to everything they believed about America the beautiful, quote-unquote, the land of the free and the home of the brave. Law enforcement officers came. They saw the chaos, and they were pissed. And they were ready to kick some civil rights Negroes and anti-war protesters' ass. Now, I've referenced the Vietnam War for a particular reason, because it had a profound catalytic effect on what followed in the killing of Daniel Thomas. Because in the early morning hours of July 23rd, 1967, 29 days after those fatal pistol shots were fired in Rouge Park, Detroit police raided an after-hours club at 9125 12th Street, and this was near the corner of Claremont and 12th. Sidney Fine, in his masterful book, Violence and the Model City, the Kavanaugh Administration, Race Relations and the Detroit Riot of 1967, he describes it as, quote, a dingy second floor apartment above a vacant print shop, unquote. And the time was about 3:30 a.m. on a warm, humid night in the hood. So, what, you ask? And what the hell is an after-hours club anyway? Well, I will explain that later. And how does such a place have any relationship whatsoever what happened to Daniel Thomas 18 months before in Rouge Park? And how are the two possibly connected in any way? Well, if you take the time to think about it for a moment, there are many layers to this tragedy. Each has its very own foundation, and each has its own truth that it stands upon. So let me allow me to explain, please, that this is what happened. And this is why it happened. And this is how it's connected. And this is why it matters. As Detroiters of a certain age have always known, when you think of 12th Street of that time, think of the Las Vegas Strip. Think of bright, shiny casino lights that you can see from space. Think of people always lined up 4 and 5 deep, crowding sidewalks, moving in and out of brightly lit lounges, bars, jazz clubs, strip clubs, gambling joints, music lounges, all-night eateries, brothels, you name it. Money flowed in and out of 12th Street like the tide going in and out. And, of course, there was prostitution. There was lots of it. There were these fine-ass black women. There were fine-ass white women. There were gays, trans, Whatever your kink, whatever you wanted, you could find it on 12th Street. And it was always there. Always there. And it was always busy. And it was always ready. And 12th Street never slept. Never. And as long as you had the money, you could find it on 12th Street. And after hours clubs were an African-American institution, especially in Detroit. And they first originated during the height of segregation when African-Americans were barred from attending the major white nightclubs and other hangouts after hours when everything else closed at 2 o'clock in the morning. Thus, an enterprising person would find a vacant storefront or an empty apartment and set up a full-service bar and kitchen that opened after hours. Closed prudishly and precisely at 2 a.m. Thus, after-hour joints, or blind pigs, as they were otherwise called, attracted the not-so-ready-to-go-home-yet crowd. They attracted prominent athletes, both local and from out of state. They attracted prominent businessmen, both local and from out of state. They attracted gamblers. They attracted the sex trade, of course. They attracted off-duty doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, auto workers, professional people. They attracted anybody who was seeking some diversion. Of course, there was illegal liquor being sold and lots of chicken, coleslaw, and fries. And they were always stuffed with black people and a smattering of whites here and there. 12th Street was Detroit's version of the Vegas Strip, with hookers and gays on the side. And 12th Street was the perfect place to put a blind pig. And it was always lit up, always packed, always glittering. There was always money to be spent in nefarious pursuits. And there was money to be made by both legitimate and illegitimate means. There was always money to be made, period. And there was always these people for whom, quote unquote, normal was never quite enough. And there were always certain types of people always looking for more action that was always beyond what was considered normal. And these people came in all colors and ethnic groups. And of course, the joke is that after hours joints are illegal. And of course they are. However, at 10 p.m. or at 10:30 p.m. on the 22nd of July, 1967, two black plainclothes vice squad officers assigned to the 10th precinct attempted entry to the after-hours joint at 9125 12th Street, and they were turned away by the downstairs doorman. One of the officers kept insisting that he was a professional basketball player from the Cincinnati Royals, which are now the Sacramento Kings, by the way, who was in town and was, quote-unquote, looking for some action, whatever that meant. The two officers persisted, but they were constantly stymied by the doorman until about 3:45 a.m., when they managed to slip by the doorman with a group of several beautiful young women wearing tight skirts. 10 minutes later, the actual raid began with a sledgehammer smashing the downstairs glass window. Just so happened the place was chock full of people celebrating the return home of two Vietnam combat veterans who had just returned from the war, and a third soldier who was leaving for the war in 2 days. The servicemen were all black. All were in full Class A dress uniforms, bedecked with medals, shoulder braids, and all that other military decorative gear that they wear. As soon as the cops rushed in, the place exploded in chaos. People were scrambling everywhere trying to escape. Vice crews were trying to catch anyone they could. Pandemonium spilled down the stairway like a flood and out onto 12th Street, where 10th Precinct wagons waited to transport the arrested to the police station several blocks away to the west. Each 10th Precinct Transport held 14 prisoners, and the vice squad sergeant had to order two more transports to accommodate all the people arrested. And this is when the crowd began to gather around the transport wagons as the arrested were being loaded onto the vans. A small crowd of 200 or 300, which wouldn't have been unusual because 12th Street was always bumper-to-bumper traffic and sidewalks full of people from sunset to sunrise, especially during the spring and summer months. However, by the time the last 10th Precinct wagon was being loaded, the crowds outside of the Blind Pig had grown even more, and the temperature of the crowd began to rise. Sidney Fine describes them as, quote, elements of the 12th Street bar scene, with some petty gamblers and other underworld nefarious types, as well as some of the, quote, unquote, black middle-class factory workers on their way to work, regular 12th Street regulars, unquote. But there was also a certain level of frustration when some eyewitnesses reported later that police began to physically assault some of the women prisoners and push the handcuffed woman prisoner down a flight of stairs from the upstairs club. There was a certain type of energy that you could feel that began to gather and begin to crackle through the crowd. And it was reported, and I don't know how true this is, that police hit one of the arrested men, hit him upside the head when he refused to produce identification. That energy accelerated when it was reported again, and I cannot confirm this. A young black woman stuck her head out of the 10th Precinct wagon window and shouted, "Brutality!" just before she was clobbered by a cop standing nearby. And this action caused the crowd to erupt into its own action. There were shouts of black power rang out. Another shout was heard, "Look at what they're doing to our people." And chillingly, someone else hollered, "Kill them whitey motherfuckers. Get the bricks and bottles going." Someone baptized a young white officer standing guard near the door of the raided after-hour joint when a full beer bottle flew out of the crowd and shattered at his feet and baptized his uniform trousers with beer. The crowd began moving forward, closing in on the police standing guard. The cops did their best to establish and hold a firm perimeter. However, there was this palpable tension as the crowd continued to grow. And after the police finally shoved the last of the prisoners into the wagons and drove away at 4:40 a.m., police gave the order to finally pull out of the area. And as they did so, bricks, bottles, and beer bottles, bricks, rocks, sticks, anything that could be grabbed and thrown instantly flew after the last police cruiser in formation, and a brick shattered the rear window of the last car out of Dodge. A loud cheer rose from the crowd as these cop cars sped away south on 12th Street into the night. As the police roared away to the 10th Precinct, the crowd in front of the after-hours joint grew even larger. They were now crackling with furious energy, and you could almost feel it going from one person to the other. And they were egged on by at least two instigators who seemed to have had enough of the police brutal behavior toward African Americans in 1967. And these two young men exhorted the crowd, and the crowd continued to feed upon their positive energy and grow larger. But more about them later. And so again, according to Sidney Fine, around about 5 a.m., the crowd had grown exponentially to several hundred people, and the police became aware of the possibility of a crowd control problem. Drove out to the 12th Street location with Sergeant Lawrence Mulvihill to assess the situation. He saw the crowd and stepped out of the car. As soon as he did, he was felled by a chunk of concrete that struck him behind the left ear. It just came flying out of the crowd and struck him behind the left ear. Dazed and bleeding, Lieutenant Good got back to his feet, staggered back to his car and shouted for Sergeant Mulvihill to hit the gas. As the police car zoomed away south on 12th Street, Lieutenant Good recalled people surging into the streets behind him, screaming, shouting, throwing bricks, rocks, bottles, and bricks. One of the undercover vice officers, Joseph Brown, who remained behind after the bus, saw, quote, young people running around throwing unknown objects and breaking windows. Officer Brown wisely remained undercover and faded into the crowd until he could get back to safety at the 10th Precinct. Smart move on his part, though. And so, at 5:30 a.m. on the morning of July 23rd, 1967, the Detroit Rebellion officially began. 29 days after Daniel Thomas was shot dead in Rouge Park, a routine police raid on an after-hours joint metastasized into 7 days of arson fires, looting, mayhem on both sides, and the destruction of personal and business property to the tune of $170 million in 1967 dollars. There were 7,321 arrests, 47 deaths. Police-targeted violence resulted in 8 cold-blooded murders by the police. But there was something else, too. And there was something so shocking that it sent shockwaves of reactionary fear through conservative white America. And that was, for at least 2 to 3 nights in a row, insurrectionist snipers battled Detroit police and National Guard riflemen to a standstill all along several blocks in the heart of the riot zone, and in some instances drove the police and the National Guard out of these areas. As they watched this play out on national and local television, that this shockingly effective African-American resistance toward a police force that appeared to have been solely charged and created with using all of its resources to keep Detroit's Negroes from enjoying the full accoutrement of American citizenship with decades and decades of targeted official violence, oppression, and harassment. And when the shit finally hit the fan and Negroes erupted in full fury, millions of American white folks were absolutely clueless as to why. Millions of others were teeth-cracking furious at Negroes' exposure of the hypocrisy of the meaningless mantra of, quote-unquote, all men are created equal, of American society and culture for the whole world to witness. They called for an extremist final solution to the American Negro problem. Imagine that, if you will. A few politicians proposed behind closed doors a Von C-style, quote-unquote, final solution to the American Negro problem, in whatever form that might best take. As we sit here listening to this podcast about something that happened 50-plus years ago, let that sink in for a moment. Because with apologies to Charlton Heston in Planet of the Apes and Dan Carlin of Hardcore History, where I first heard this analogy, this was for the quote-unquote silent majority and the establishment, the cracks in the dike, that moment in the Planet of the Apes movie, that Statue of Liberty in the sand moment, where the powers that be and some of the lesser powers are faced with certain realities of race and inequality in America. And the only solution that immediately comes to mind of these people is a final one. And so on the night of July 23rd, 1967, one of the most beautiful evenings within my memory, it was that kind of warm summer night where people sat on their porches or on their stairs until deep in the night, talking. But on this night, as I stood on the corner of Hazelwood and Warren Avenue and stared at the eastern sky in awe, I saw the light from several square blocks of the 12th Street neighborhood engulfed in roaring flames and billowing clouds of roiling black smoke, filling up the night sky and drifting across the city on a gentle breeze. I was convinced I was standing in the middle of one of the old newsreels of World War II that was sometimes shown on television. I saw flames from entire neighborhoods licking the bottoms of white clouds in the night sky,
I saw entire neighborhoods consumed with flames and thick black smoke. I heard sirens echoing everywhere, coming and going to the point where it never stopped. Houses, commercial buildings, two-family flats were consumed by fire, and their skeletons soon collapsed into the streets. I saw and heard sidewalks buckling from the heat and red masonry bricks cracking wide open with the most god-awful smell ever. Now, I enjoy history, and especially the history of World War II. And what I saw that night was as close to resembling the firebombing of Dresden as I've ever witnessed. It was the acrid smell of burning wood, roof shingles, and who knows, God knows what else went up in flames that night. And the smell, as I remember that smell, which is forever burned in my memory, imagine everything that can go up in flames does go up in flames. It was an unbelievable, unimaginable smell that cloistered our neighborhoods and lingered for days. When I looked up at the sky to the east that night, what I saw was an indescribable sight of the entire sky over the 12th and 14th Street neighborhoods glowing a brilliant reddish orange. The rising heat shaped and reshaped the clouds into different forms, but they never gave up that strange color. And the bottoms of those clouds were glowing a brilliant red that I was sure would never, ever be duplicated again. It was a sight that I will never, ever forget, and it was a smell that I will never, ever forget. I can still hear the sirens, and the rapid-fire gunshots and rapid-fire shots in return, and they still haunt me, and I'll never forget them, especially when I remember what was done in the dark and what was done in the shadows. And so, on August 2nd, 1967, the burning, the shooting, and the looting stopped. Smoke still hung over the city, and the smell of smoke was inescapable. 43 people were dead. Hundreds more were injured in the chaos, confusion, and mayhem of a racial spark that had been smoldering for decades and which a liberal regime had not been able to prevent. The shock amongst the city's residents had been hard-hitting and dislocating at the same time, coupled with the Richter scale shift in the hardening of attitudes and stereotypes. Things would never, ever be the same. This insurrection, which no one had saw coming, was at that time, before Rodney King and the Los Angeles riot of 1992, in the words of Sidney Fine, that author of Violence and the Motor City, was, quote, the most destructive civil disturbance in the history of the country, unquote. And this aftermath of such a peacetime displacement of thousands of people from their homes, businesses, and places of employment was only just settling in. The consequences of this aftershock was continual instability in more ways than one, and in ways the average Detroiter never imagined nor ever clearly understood. And in a bizarre sort of quote-unquote unicorn sort of way, all of the inequities, the injustices, and the failures of correction were clearly brought into focus by what happened to Daniel Thomas and his wife Louise in Rouge Park that night in June 1967. And that was only exacerbated by the explosion on 12th Street 1 month later. No matter how hard officials tried to separate the two incidents, they would always, forever, be joined at the hip. In the aftermath of the riot, the justice system began to grind forward once again. And the trial of Michael Posholopek began to lurch forward to its start, finally, in December 1968, 18 months after Daniel Thomas's murder. Now, I should mention here, full civil rights for African Americans had only been achieved 3 years before, in 1965. And even though sincere, Herculean efforts were being made to fully integrate African Americans into being Americans, the American justice system and the people who operated the machinery did not get that memo. The jury system in Detroit's Recorder's Court, as it was known then, were still all white. From the prosecutor's office to the courtroom clerks to the deputies in the courtrooms to the court reporters to the prospective jurors, they were all white all the time. In Recorder's Court in the late 1960s and early 70s, African Americans, even the obviously innocent ones, received two types of justice, slim and none. And with the conviction rates of African Americans running somewhere between 98%. Additionally, African Americans were also systemically excluded from the jury selection process as well as from jury duty at a rate of 95%. This continued until the early 1970s when a young, dynamic radical lawyer named Kenneth Cockrell blew the whole thing up with a lawsuit specifically targeting Detroit's lack of black jurors in a city that was then close to 50% black. And as a consequence, the lack of black representation on juries would have a positive effect on Michael Posholopek and his upcoming trial. And so, on December 27, 1968, the first-degree murder trial of Michael Posholopek finally begins. The jury has been scrupulously selected from Detroit's voter registration list. 12 jurors and 2 alternates. 14 jurors in all. And positively no black people on the jury. They've all been excluded through the peremptory challenges, which was a practice that would soon bite the Wayne County prosecutor, William Cahalan, right in the ass. Therefore, the entire trial would be viewed through working class white lens, fine-tuned into a focus with all this institutional racism and biases attacked, without challenge, because there were no asterisk Negroes on the jury panel. So the judge, Samuel Olson, swears the jury in and explains how the jury system is supposed to work based on the U.S. Constitution, composed of a jury of 12 men, but that changed in 1920 with the 20th Amendment giving women the right to vote. And those 12 jurors must reach a unanimous verdict one way or the other. So the prosecutor presents his case against Michael Posholopek, the accused. They start with the chronology of the events that night, the phone calls to Detroit Police Dispatch from neighbors living on the periphery of Rouge Park, reporting a loud disturbance followed by what the callers identified as quote-unquote gunshots, the dispatching of several police cars from the 16th precinct to the scene and what they discovered when they rolled up there, Daniel Thomas lying face down on the ground, suffering from a gunshot wound to the forehead, and his wife, Louise Thomas, kneeling by his side, filling the night with her screams. Of police not waiting for an ambulance and transporting Daniel to the nearest Detroit hospital, although a closer suburban hospital may have been a better choice, all the police reports generated that night were introduced into evidence, as well as the witness statements from several of the young people who were in the park that night, 16 young people in all. Prosecutors introduced the doctor who examined Daniel Thomas when he arrived at the hospital that night, and the doctor who had pronounced him dead of a gunshot wound to his forehead. Prosecutors introduced the pathologist who recovered the spent .22 caliber bullet from Daniel's skull during the autopsy of his body and proclaimed that Daniel had expired from a gunshot wound fired from approximately 10 to 15 yards away and that the death was assured from the location of the wound, that the manner of Daniel's death was homicide. Prosecutors introduced further evidence of how and why Daniel and Louise were in the park that night, a Friday night with two friends who lived in the same apartment building, were just listening to Motown on Daniel's portable record player and drinking beer. And Daniel just wanted to relax after a hard week as a welder in Ford Motor Company's Rouge plant. Things had been uneventful in the park until Michael Posholopek and a companion arrived at the location later on that evening. Michael Posholopek announced his presence at the location by firing a single shot into the air from a chrome-plated derringer that he was known to frequently carry. He and his friends were drawn to Daniel and Louise's location like moths to a flame, with much of the same outcome as it eventually turned out. Michael Posholopic and friends were initially welcomed by Daniel and Louise and the other couple, but as later reported by two or three of the other witnesses, they soon wore out their welcome with their boorish behavior. Prosecutors carefully walked the jury through the next sequence of events, with the group of young white guys gathering, and their drinking getting out of hand, and several sexually provocative suggestions made regarding Louise, of quote-unquote raping Louise before the night was over. And prosecutors pointing out the author of that lewd suggestion was none other than Michael Posholopic. The other couple with the Thomases became uncomfortable with the crowd of young, drunk white guys and decided to leave. However, they had no transportation, so they asked for a ride home. And one of the young guys at the scene who wasn't drunk agreed to, but he didn't have a car. So he ended up driving that couple home using Daniel's car with Louise accompanying him. And he and Louise returned to Rouge Park approximately 45 minutes later. At that time, the mood had turned ugly between Daniel and some of the drunk young white guys. It was suggested by several witnesses that a few of the drunken white guys disgustingly suggested that Louise go along with what at that time was known as pulling a train. That is, several guys have sex with a single female, one after the other. And that's when the Thomases angrily decided to leave. They had to fight their way to their vehicle, however, and in their haste to leave without their portable record player. When they made it to their car, Daniel put the key in the ignition and turned it, and the car would not start. The car had just cranked and cranked and cranked, whining with that unique sound of a car that has energy but just won't start. That same vehicle was clearly working several minutes before, which led prosecutors to surmise that the car had been tampered with so Daniel and Louise couldn't leave. So the prosecutors continued on with their chronology, which now had Daniel and Louise hurriedly leaving the car and running to the Rouge Park maintenance building, which was 50 to 100 yards away, and the two of them ran under a bombardment of empty beer bottles, stones, and angrily shouted racial epithets. But they made it to the maintenance building, where a spineless caretaker whimpered that he couldn't let them in or he would lose his job. And here is an excellent example, if I can digress for a moment, of the strangulating power of oppressive racism. A black caretaker denying sanctuary to a black couple under deadly assault by a group of whites, because if he opens the door and gives them sanctuary, he will lose his job, as opposed to Daniel Thomas being murdered. This was perhaps the saddest inflection point of this entire tragic incident. The shouts of anger from white guys grew louder and louder as Daniel shouted for Louise to run for safety, as he launched himself furiously at the crowd to give her a chance to escape. And that's when a shot rang out, and that's when Daniel fell, mortally wounded in the forehead. Michael Posholopic and his pack of followers fled into the pitch dark of Rouge Park's 1,000 plus wooded acres, as Louise Thomas's plaintive wails of horror filled the night as police sirens could be heard fast approaching in the distance. Now, the prosecutors acknowledged that police did a fantastic job of rounding up the Rouge Park troublemaker regulars and collecting physical evidence of what had happened. And when faced with the reality of where this incident was going, some of those very same Michael Posholopic sycophants gave him up right away as the shooter. They gave up the guy who was with him as well. And his companion's name is known, however, I won't reveal it here because I've been unable to determine if he's still above ground. From quote-unquote saving their own ass witness statements led cops to zero in on Michael Posholopic as the shooter. They arrested him very early the following morning. In fact, as soon as daylight cracked over the horizon. He was asleep when the apartment manager let them into his apartment, where Michael Posholupic lived with his young wife, and his companion was simultaneously arrested at his home address several blocks away. Additionally, DPD evidence technicians recovered the murder weapon several blocks away from the murder scene and within three blocks of where Michael Posholupic lived. In fact, it was found along a reasonable, shortest possible route someone who lived in Michael Posholupic's Southfield apartment would have taken from Rouge Park. The weapon was a .22 chrome-plated Derringer, unregistered and listed as possibly stolen. Michael Posholupic was Mirandized at the 16th Precinct, where detectives interviewed him at length as he inferred that he understood what being Mirandized meant. He initialed his Miranda warning sheet. He signed it. He dated it. And during the interview, he confessed to shooting Daniel Thomas with a .22 caliber Derringer pistol that he owned. Prosecutors also mentioned that Daniel Thomas's portable record player was also recovered from the trunk of the car owned by Michael Posholupic's companion, the one who was always by his side throughout the entire evening. Witness after witness decided to save their own ass, and they went to the stand, and they pointed directly at Michael Posholupic as the shooter. And as the guy who set the evening's ugly mood in motion by declaring loud enough for several of them to hear, "I'm gonna have sex with her, Louise Thomas, before the night is over." They fingered Michael Posholupic as the one who gave the order to disable the Thomas's car so they couldn't leave Rouge Park until he, Michael Posholupic, got what he wanted, and that was to have sex with Louise Thomas. It was Michael Posholupic who fired up the rest when Daniel Thomas fired back that if Michael Posholupic wanted to fuck, he should go fuck himself. That, according to witnesses, is when the actual fight between Daniel and the crowd exploded. Now, I'm just speculating on this portion of the narrative, but I'm convinced that the white guys were doubly infuriated when Daniel Thomas was effectively holding them off, even though he was only 5 feet eight and 136 pounds. Now, witnesses testify that it was Michael Posholupic and nobody but who fired the fatal shot from a pistol in his possession, and that everyone in the park that night knew that he had done so. And witnesses testified that Michael Posholupic fled the scene with everyone else when Daniel Thomas fell mortally wounded. Prosecutors concluded their case against Michael Posholupic by iterating that only Michael Posholupic's fingerprints were found on the recovered Derringer. I repeat, only Michael Posholupic's fingerprints were found on the recovered Derringer. Only Michael Posholupic's and no one else. And given the conclusive evidence against him, the testimony of witnesses, the ownership of the murder weapon, the sexual threats against Louise Thomas, the orchestrated attack on Daniel and Louise Thomas, witness testimony that they saw Michael Posholupic aim and pull the trigger, quote unquote, prosecutors asked the jury, do the right thing, as if already suspecting that they might do otherwise, and to convict Michael Posholupic of the first-degree murder of Daniel Thomas. The defense, however, shrewdly, they saw things quite differently. They crafted a defense specifically designed for an all-white jury sitting in judgment of a young white business owner, married young white guy, accused of killing what was then known as a quote-unquote colored fella. Their defense was a clear example of how different cultures, in this case black and white cultures, view the same event quite differently. Black people at the time saw a clear case of a white guy murdering a young black guy who was protecting his wife against sexual assault. Now, this was something that any guy should do, no matter what color they are. Daniel Thomas wasn't a thug looking for trouble. He was upright, stand-up guy who survived a year of combat in Vietnam only to be shot dead by Michael Posilopek, who drunkenly wanted to explore the contagion of jungle fever. To black people, the evidence was as clear as spring water bubbling up out of the ground. Michael Posilopek clearly was a murderer, pure and simple. To white folks, and especially the all-white jury of 1968, Michael Posilopek was possibly an unfortunate victim of mistaken identity. An innocent, hard-working young white guy with a business and a wife who had suffered enough. After all, he had been locked away in the Wayne County Jail for 18 months. He has had to be perpetually confined to protective custody because, without his .22 or his crew backing him up, it turns out that Michael Posilopek wasn't that tough. According to his attorneys, as they stared directly at the jury, black inmates in the jail had made Michael Posilopek's life a living hell. They repeatedly took his meals away from him, and they beat him if he complained to deputies. In fact, he had lost several fights with black inmates. Outside of the jail, his wife had had to leave her good job at Wayne County as a supply secretary because the black females at her job shunned her, where once they were friendly. His gas station that he had purchased the year before had been repossessed because, well, he was locked up, and his wife couldn't keep it going alone because she had her own problems at work. He'd been evicted from his apartment, and visits from his wife were becoming fewer and far between. And to top it all off, according to his attorneys, Michael Posilopek was as innocent as a newborn baby. He did not do this thing. And the police had caused Michael Posilopek's life to crumble into ruin because they had the wrong guy. And in their haste to put a cap on a simmering racial volcano that was about to explode at Daniel Thomas's pseudo-lynching, and actually did explode a month later, the police not only had arrested the wrong guy, they had probably arrested the wrong white guy. The police had mistakenly swept up Michael Posilopek because he was known to frequent Rouge Park as a place where he loved to drink beer. Now, this was his attorney's argument. Michael Posilopek was also known to police. His attorneys stipulated that he was in the park that night, and that the Derringer was his, and it was stolen, and it was not registered, and that Michael Posilopek was drunk, and that he did fire a shot into the air from the Derringer to announce his presence. His attorney stipulated that they did meet Daniel and Louise Thomas in the park that night, and they had been friendly, and that they were listening to Motown music and drinking beer. Michael Posilopek's attorney stipulated that there were at least a dozen other people in the park that night who were at or around the so-called festivities. His attorney stipulated that Michael Posilopek was indeed a loudmouth and a troublemaker who considered Rouge Park his personal fiefdom. His attorney also stipulated that Michael Posilopek may have even loudly proclaimed to the ears of his sickle fans that he was going to have sex with Louise Thomas before the night was over one way or another. But his attorney very strongly iterated that despite his being drunk, despite his reputation as a loudmouth, troublemaking braggart, Michael Posilopek did not pull the trigger on Daniel Thomas. Someone else did. This is the version Michael Posilopek's attorney put in front of the jury. It was custom tailored for the jury that it was put in front of. Michael Posilopic was drunk, as he usually was that night. He was in Rouge Park that night. He was around and possibly in the company of Daniel and Louise that night. But his attorney stressed the quote-unquote but. When the fight over Louise started, Michael Posilopic was knocked to the ground by someone not named Daniel Thomas, and he was temporarily passed out, despite all the noise and the screaming. Someone took the derringer from his hand and fired the fatal shot at Daniel Thomas, then put the derringer back in Michael Posilopic's hand. When people started running away from the scene, Michael Posilopic somehow got up and ran too. And in support of this theory, one of the witnesses advised the court that someone had recently fired shots at him near his home. He had no idea who it was, but he suspected that it was the pre-O.J. Simpson quote-unquote real killer who fired those shots at him. The police, however, had no corroborating evidence regarding this report or regarding this incident. There were no reports. There was no nothing. And why the judge allowed this before the jury is still a mystery. But he did. And it provided just the lifeline the jury needed to spare Michael Posilopic a lifetime in prison for killing a black man in cold blood while trying to protect his wife. And so the jury got the case on December 30th, 1968, after closing arguments. Prosecution reiterated time and again that Michael Posilopic did it. The defense said the police simply had the wrong guy. And after just a few hours of deliberating, the jury came back and acquitted Michael William Posilopic of all charges associated with the death of Daniel Thomas. They looked into the alternate shooter theory. They looked into an unknown, amorphous person who fired the fatal shot at Daniel Thomas while Michael Posilopic lay passed out on the ground with the derringer in his hand. This amorphous someone else tried to kill one of the witnesses against Michael Posilopic, allegedly. And the jury bought this. Or else, if they really didn't buy it, they had just cashed Daniel Thomas's life out as worth only 18 months of Michael William Posilopic's existence. A huge smile of relief spread across Michael Posilopic's exhausted face. Louise Thomas and Daniel Thomas's families erupted in the courtroom in outrage. To them, this was just more conclusive evidence that no matter the facts, no matter the circumstances, no matter direct eyewitness testimony, no matter direct evidence, justice for a black man in America was as elusive as justice against a black man was certain. Judge Olson had to bang the gavel more than once to keep order while Michael Posilopic's attorneys patted him on the back and congratulated each other on a job well done. Louise Thomas burst into tears while her family comforted her. Unknown to the jury at this time, Louise Thomas had been 3 months pregnant on the night of June 27, 1967, with her and Daniel's first child. The stress of the past 18 months had caused her to miscarry this child. And the acquittal of Michael Posilopic very nearly broke this young 28-year-old black woman. And so Michael Posilopic had just dodged a huge bullet. It was, however, a BB that nailed his ass. He was not let go. He was now being held on possession of a stolen vehicle found at his gas station when police searched it for further evidence of that night in Rouge Park, June 27, 1967. If there is a prologue to this tragedy,
It is that the more things change, the more they stay the same. In fact, if we could somehow get our hands on Mr. Peabody's time machine or another time machine, that would get us there but would not leave us stranded, we would find 1967 full of social energy and sudden forward progress that was equally discombobulating and threatening to the patriarchal white culture and the white working class at that time. And the axis of this sphere clearly was 1965 and Lyndon Baines Johnson's betrayal of the signing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Together, these two acts finally granted African Americans the full accoutrements of citizenship after 346 years of quote-unquote otherness. This should have been a joyous American celebration coast to coast. But amongst many of the white working class and the middle class, the Negroes gaining a full citizenship did not go over very well. No, not at all. A very good number of whites rebelled. I mean, rebelled at the thought of a Negroes having the very same rights as they did. This most assuredly would mean challenge for everything worthy of being American. And most whites preferred the old way and indeed yearned for the old way of doing things, both de facto and de jure. So furious were they, the backlash was doubly intense. And millions of them expressed their outrage at Negroes becoming full citizens, and they left the Democratic Party and became Republicans. Staunch, Negro-hating Republicans who strive to put in the path of every achieving Negro they could find some obstacle that they could justify. Suddenly, by a law signed by a Deep South Texan, there was competition for jobs, houses, careers, which schools to go to, etc., etc. Negroes were suddenly no longer at the end of the line. And more of them were going places they'd never been before. The white backlash against this social energy was intense, and it was everywhere, especially in the white working class cities and all white neighborhood enclaves for decades were suddenly being integrated. That scenario played out far too many times to count, and white people, when they could, were openly killing and inflicting extrajudicial punishment on African Americans and then walking away completely unscathed with a pass and a pat on the back from a criminal justice system that gives the perpetrators a wink and a nod. After all, Supreme Court Justice Taney once opined in the Dred Scott decision, quote, "There are no laws regarding Negroes which a white man is bound to respect." But you can insert, no matter what they do, they will never be held accountable. The most egregious recent example of this American phenomenon is George Zimmerman's murder of Trayvon Martin, or the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department's murder of Michael Brown, or the NYPD's murder of Amadou Diallo, the guy with the wallet in his hand who received 41 bullets for having a wallet in his hand. Or the 8-minute long videotape of the 5 LAPD officers beating the snot out of Rodney King with batons and being acquitted despite video evidence of their being way over the line in their use of force. And were it not for a brave young black girl with an iPhone, Derek Chauvin would have gotten away with murdering George Floyd in Minneapolis. White men have always gotten away with murdering black men, no matter black people, no matter the circumstances. It's as though these unjust outcomes are constitutionally required. However, when the dynamic changes, as change is evolutionary, immediate corrective response action often follows. And it's often disguised as quote-unquote efficiency.
For example, in 1992 in Detroit, two white police officers were convicted in the murder of Malice Green, an unarmed Detroiter who was beaten to death for refusing to open his hand where he had a small packet of drugs. A predominantly black jury convicted the two white police officers. It was the first time in the history of Detroit that a white person had been convicted of doing physical harm to a black person. People rejoiced in that finally, the scales of justice had shifted as Detroit now had a predominantly black city and a black court-mandated jury system. Reforms resulted in most juries in Detroit being mostly black. Well, of course, you know, that didn't last long. Michigan's conservative Republican Governor John Inglis was as shocked by the verdict against the two white officers as were most white people. Within a year of the two police officers' conviction, John Inglis had ordered Detroit's Recorder's Court, the most efficient court in the land with docket management, to be disbanded and merged into the Wayne County Third Circuit Court system, where juries were drawn from the entirety of Wayne County. The result was that juries in Detroit were no longer predominantly black, and the underlying threat of white people being convicted by black juries diminished greatly. The jury in the Michael Posholopic killing of Daniel Thomas represented several things that factored into the acquittal, with a carefully crafted defense designed to view the murder of Daniel Thomas through a white middle-class values and culture under siege lens. What had happened in the park that night had to be seen as a different interpretation of what Louise Thomas experienced. Black Detroiters interpreted what had happened as a young black man, a CIB wearer, and that is a combat infantryman's badge, a Vietnam veteran who survived a year of combat in Vietnam, returns to Detroit, only to be shot dead by a young white man intent upon having non-consensual sex with Daniel Thomas's wife. And Daniel Thomas paid for physically resisting by having his life stolen from him by an enraged young white guy who, say, having forced sex with Louise Thomas as his God-given white man's right. To black people everywhere, without a doubt, Michael Posholopic was a murderer. And in seeing things differently, white people saw Michael Posholopic as a possible victim of mistaken identity. An innocent, hardworking young man who had suffered enough for the police outrageous arrest of an innocent man. After all, the defense attorneys lamented as they looked at this all-white jury, the client has sat in the Wayne County Jail for 18 months. He has had to be locked away in solitary confinement because the black inmates continually beat him and take his food away. The client's wife had to quit her good-paying job at Wayne County. You know, as I said earlier, because the black secretary shunned her. The gas station he purchased the year before was in foreclosure because his wife and his family couldn't keep up the payments. He had been evicted from his department. Jailhouse visits from his wife were becoming less and less frequent. The cops, his defense attorney implored the jury, had acted hastily to cool down a simmering racial volcano that was primed to explode as the rage of black people at Daniel Thomas's pseudo-lynching. Consequently, the police swept up poor Michael Posholopic because he was a known Rouge Park troublemaker. His attorney stipulated that he was in the park that night and the stolen derringer. All of that, okay. He fired a shot in the air and announced his arrival. The attorneys stipulated that Michael Posholopic was a loathsome person, a loudmouth, a braggart,
And one witness who was in the park that night even testified that Michael Posholupi considered Rouge Park his personal territory. But his attorneys were adamant that Michael Posholupi didn't shoot and kill Daniel Thomas, despite his written confession that was read to the jury by one of the interrogating detectives. This was the theory that Michael Posholupi's attorneys presented to the jury. When the fight started, Michael Posholupi was knocked to the ground by someone not named Daniel Thomas, and he passed out. Someone other than Michael Posholupi took the derringer out of Posholupi's hands, fired the fatal shot that killed Daniel Thomas, then placed the pistol in Posholupi's drunken, outstretched hand. However, after the fatal shot was fired, Michael Posholupi got to his feet and ran for the woods, just like everyone else. Let's not pretend here. Everyone who was on that jury was born at a time when African Americans were invisible to white America as a whole. If you were anything other than an entertainer or an athlete, as a black person, you were, in effect, invisible. There were still quote-unquote white and quote-unquote colored water fountains in existence at this time. The lunch counter at Detroit's downtown Woolworth was only integrated in 1960. There were still all-white neighborhoods and all-black neighborhoods. All-white movie houses, black movie houses, all-white restaurants where black people couldn't go. Churches, playgrounds, sides of streets, etc., etc. And truth be told, there was very little association unless it was in the workplace. The divide between white and black was as hard of a divide as the Berlin Wall. And much like the Berlin Wall, there were the severest of penalties for trying to cross it. Most of them were extreme or extrajudicial, calculated from the moment of birth. Black equals guilty. White equals benefit of the doubt. The racism and other biases inculcated into white lives from birth was difficult for anyone to overcome overnight, I'm sure. They were ingrained and not easily dislodged or separated. Subsequently, when LBJ 1965 and quote-unquote open housing landed on the national scene as a result of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, the quote-unquote greatest generation of white folks who Gary Brokaw alleged won World War II, they lost their collective minds. They streamed out of the cities like lemmings going over the cliff, especially in Detroit, away from Negroes and perceived equality. Detroit was full of organized white neighborhood citizens associations who didn't quite look upon housing integration or open housing as the fulfillment of the American dream. Instead, they viewed it as the quote-unquote Negro invasion, and they expressed this sentiment openly, hostily, and without hesitation, because the prevailing culture at that time allowed it. This sentiment was expressed thousands of times by thousands of openly hostile letters generated and forwarded to the mayor at that time, Jerome P. Kavanaugh, a liberal mayor who won election with overwhelming support from the black community. Here is a brief example of three letters picked at random from the Jerome P. Kavanaugh collection from the Burton Historical Collection at the main library of the Detroit Library Branch. This letter is from Rita, who lives in the Warrendale neighborhood, which stretches from Greenfield Avenue to Rouge Park. And this is a distance of approximately 5 square miles with a good number of people in it at that time, 99% of whom were white. And Rita is a housewife and an older mother. And she writes, "Mr. Mayor, I'm writing this letter because of the greatest concern. My son, Danny, is a brand new policeman, and we're also proud of him. But yesterday, while I was sitting on my porch, my son, Danny, drove up in his police car. I was shocked to see Danny was riding with a Negro in a policeman's uniform. I was shocked, but I kept a straight face. They were only there for a moment, and Danny wanted me to see him in his new policeman's uniform. And then they left to finish patrolling. Well, Mr. Kavanaugh, I do not approve of this for two reasons. My son Danny is a new police officer, and I do not believe Negroes are qualified to be police officers. I do not want Danny catching any Negro diseases and bringing them home to his sister or myself. So, Mr. Mayor, I voted for you, and I would like you to either transfer the Negro from Danny's car or transfer Danny. He is assigned to the precinct on McGraw Street, and his full name is Daniel da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Of course, I'm not going to give the last name. And I did not disclose Rita's last name in the event that she's still with us, or Danny is still with us, but you get the picture. This second letter is from Marion. Marion is a male. Marion is a steel worker who works for a heat induction coke-fired industrial furnace manufacturer on the west side of Detroit. And this is his letter, dated August 5th, 1967, 1 week after the end of the Detroit insurrection or the riot or whatever your preference in naming it is. Dear Mr. Mayor, Marion writes, I'm extremely disappointed in how your administration handled the disgusting nigger riot that just ended. You should have ordered your police to start shooting when they started burning and looting. You cannot let them get away with that kind of jungle behavior. You cannot let them get away with this, Mr. Mayor. You simply cannot. As a taxpayer and a veteran, I demand that you and the police department hunt down and arrest every nigger looter that can be identified. This is what we did to the Germans in 1965, and we haven't had any trouble from them since. Do not arrest them. They do not deserve decent treatment. You must do this very soon, or Detroit will go down to nothing and be overrun by people with thick lips and nappy hair, and then it will be too late for Detroit. And finally, there is this one. The last one in a very large collection. But it's the last one I'm going to read because by now, I'm sure you're getting the picture. It perhaps is the most disturbing in its penetrating, vile sharpness of how deep systemic racism has metastasized in not just individual Americans, but also in a significant percentage of his white population. And it's from a white guy named Ernest, and it's full of fury. And this is how it goes. Quote, I did not vote for you. He's speaking of the mayor. I did not vote for you because I knew what just happened would happen. God made niggers born niggers for a reason. And you, Mr. Mayor, ignored that reason and very stupidly tried to civilize people who have only recently come down out of the trees and learned to walk upright. Have you ever tried to talk to one of them? They make no sense whatsoever. You cannot understand them, and yet you're willing to let them live anywhere in our city they choose to. You have tied the hands of the police in dealing with these animals. And now you've seen what can happen when walking, talking gorillas take over part of the city. Detroit is being destroyed by Negroes and liberal politicians like yourself. But there are some who simply won't allow them to go any further. My neighborhood association was caught off guard this time. But that won't happen again, Mr. Mayor. Next time this happens, there'll be a whole lot of dead niggers dumped on the lawn of the Manoogian Mansion because that seems to be what you want. There are thousands of white Detroiters who used to like you
and hold you in the highest regard. But that has changed. We will no longer vote for a nigger-loving mayor who stood by and let them do what they did to our city. In fact, if some of them decide to leave town after the trashing the cops gave them, you need to take your drunk Irish ass along with them. P.S. I hope all your children die suddenly. Now, this is from a voter, a white voter, okay? And the collection of Mayor Jerome P. Kavanaugh is full of these. There are literally thousands of them. So now, as any historians know, the 1960s ripped the lid off of this conformist, conservative anthill of stifling sameness that controlled most people's lives. This is why there was such a bitter backlash to finally black people finally being accorded full citizenship. Most people could handle that okay. But there were always those who simply couldn't abide full citizenship for anyone but white folks. These people, they were always, always, always given the benefit of the doubt. Hundreds of them literally got away with murder because a white jury couldn't buck culture and convict people on the facts and the evidence. And this went on all of the time. There are, I'm sure, people still haunted by nightmares that don't allow a good night's sleep, and those altering and affecting everything they do. This should be good enough punishment for the lives they stole, but it can never be actual payback. As I mentioned earlier, at the beginning of this podcast, I reached out to one of the young white guys who was there in the park that night, and we corresponded, and he actually agreed to a chat. And he was a pleasant enough fellow. He's a guy, he's in his early 70s now. And he told me everything that happened in Rouge Park that night. He told me everything that he witnessed. He pointed out who the principal players were, who said what and did what. And he described Michael Posilopic as a loathsome troublemaker who was always up to something that wasn't above board. He pretty much confirmed Michael Posilopic and his buddy were driving the mayhem bus that night, and that everything that happened to Daniel and Louise Thomas was racially motivated. This now older man expressed the deepest remorse to me and how sorry he was the whole thing happened. He told me he thought about that incident in the park often and how it was probably the root cause of his lifelong struggle with insomnia. He said before we closed our conversation, that man did not deserve what happened to him. And he said, quote, that should never have happened. And so it's been 56 years. And Louise Thomas has been lost to history. In her grief, as I was unable to locate her, I have no clue what eventually happened to her. I've often wondered if her life had any pleasantness in it at all after 1967, or if she found some sort of happiness somewhere in the swells of all of the tragedy that overwhelmed her life that night. And the cops, who I must say actually rose to the occasion, all of the officers involved have gone on to their glory, as has Judge Olson, who eventually retired from the bench. Wayne County Prosecutor William Cahalan, who closed the investigation into the murder of Daniel Thomas after Michael Posilopic's acquittal. He closed this, quote unquote, in the interest of justice. He also lost the next election to William O'Hare, who promised immediate jury system reform regarding black jurors serving on juries and sitting in judgment of white people. The reporters, the black civil rights leaders, they all have passed on. So have a good number of the rowdies who were in the park that night. However, in the sweetest piece of irony,
at least one of the young white men in the park that night met his fate on a darkened hillside in Vietnam in 1969. Such sweet irony makes one almost smile in wondering if he thought about Daniel Thomas at all as he bled out, as his life slipped away before his final breath. And one of the one guy who always wanted the attention, Michael Posielopek, well, he's gone too. Things didn't exactly work out for Michael Posielopek after his acquittal. I was unable to find any trace of productive activity in the years following his acquittal. However, according to my sources who were there that night, Michael Posielopek died in a Detroit dope house with the spike still in his arm, a drug overdose. Perhaps he turned to drugs to quell the demons and nightmares of what he'd done years before. After all, acquittal only sets you physically free. Doesn't stop the nightmares of conscience. Maybe his conscience and his nightmares proved too much for the tough guy with the derringer who liked to impress people. Maybe that's the part of the story the jury should have considered first, instead of all that other crap. But the jury, an all-white jury, with the only four blacks in all of the Wayne County jury system preemptorily excused, wasn't going to do anything other than let Michael Posielopek go, however they had to do it. Any old excuse would do, because in 1960s America, white men simply did not go to prison for doing anything to anyone black. Thus, this concludes Detroit Stories, Episode 2, The Killing of Daniel Thomas. I sincerely hope this has given you all something to think about going forward, and that Daniel Thomas was only one of an infinitesimal line of names going back in time immemorial of black men being groundlessly murdered by white men who've gotten away with it with a wink and a nod and a pat on the back. In Detroit, I could begin reading a list of names at 8 a.m. of the black, brown, and Asian men who have died at the hands of white men over the past 50 years for the stupidest of reasons. And by 8 p.m. that night, I still wouldn't be through. So as citizens, let's endeavor our mightiest to permanently change this dynamic. White men do not have a constitutional right to kill or maim people of color for no reason whatsoever, and then expect exoneration. At this point, I would all like you all to know that there are more podcasts coming from me in the very near future. All of them are Detroit stories about the city where I grew up and that I love. And all of these stories are real. All of them are about shit that couldn't have happened anywhere else but in Detroit. And one of them, and I'm very excited about this project, will be about three young revolutionary brothers who were taking it to Detroit's neighborhood drug dealers in such an effective manner that Detroit police got involved. And they got involved to the point where there were several very nasty gunfights between the brothers and the cops. There were people killed and wounded regarding this particular event in Detroit's past. And there was a manhunt by the Detroit Police Department that targeted every black male in Detroit as a suspected cop killer, subject to the most extreme extrajudicial violence imaginable. There was the most brutal, outrageous violation of a people's civil rights that had no equal in the modern history of the United States. And this period of time in the early 1970s marked the nadir of a city tumbling into the depths of civic freefall. However, this period also marked the beginning of the rise of black political power, true black political power in Detroit, and the subsequent reigning in of the unchecked power of the Detroit Police Department. And this was another very serious power struggle that encompassed even more civic dysfunction and more casualties. Another podcast coming very, very soon is the incredible, almost unbelievable, true story of a shootout between a special unit of the Detroit Police Department, the notoriously trigger-happy stress unit, that's S-T-R-E-S-S, which means stop the robberies, enjoy safe streets, and a group of off-duty Wayne County Sheriff deputies who were only playing cards in the apartment where one of them lived. One deputy was killed and three others wounded, despite identifying themselves as Wayne County Sheriff's deputies. This podcast has all the twists and turns that one can imagine and then some. And you have to seriously ask yourself, what went wrong for something like this to happen between two of the largest law enforcement agencies in the state of Michigan, where a deputy ends up dead, shot to death by Detroit police officers assigned to a specialized unit that specializes in shooting people to death? There were lots of questions asked about this, and there were lots of questions left unanswered about this. And to top it all off, when I FOIA'd, when I did a Freedom of Information Act request for the case files from both the Detroit Police Department and the Wayne County Sheriff's Department, each one, respectively, very tersely, advised me that no such file exists. But I know people who were there, and I've interviewed these people. The Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News each has an archival record of everything that happened that day in March of 1972 and in the subsequent trial of the Detroit officers that occurred later in the year. And we're going to seriously get into this incident with a very deep dive into what has become infamously known as the Rochester Street Massacre. And so all of this is coming soon. Be looking forward before the fall of 2023. I thank you all for listening. Download Detroit Stories on Apple Podcasts, Budsprout, Spotify, or wherever you go for your podcast listening. Tell all of your friends. And remember, anything you hear on these podcasts ain't none of this shit made up. I'm your host, Douglas Merriman. See you soon.